Today's daf in Masechet Pesachim, brought to you from Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, on this happy seventh day of Hanukkah, is daf Chof Vav. And we're in the middle of a machlokas. The machlokas has two formulations. The machlokas between Abaye and Rava about how to understand the famous machlokas of Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda about a davar she'eino miskaven. According to the first version, basically, the machlokas was about whether the only time that Rabbi Shimon was matir was where there was no opportunity that was convenient to do the same thing without getting into the dragging the chair, or in this case, walking by the church and perhaps smelling the smell. And so according to Abaye, there was no difference. Basically, it was a straight-out heter. You weren't responsible for finding a better solution, like lifting it up. And whereas Rava claimed, no, even according to Rabbi Shimon, there was only a heter if you didn't have an option. And the second way in which we understood the machlokas was it was a machlokas in Rabbi Yehuda. And that Abaye was saying was that according to Rabbi Yehuda, the element of your kavana is irrelevant, because as long as there would be any kind of option, doesn't matter if you aren't mechaven, you are mechaven. It's only if, according to him, if there is no other option, so then okay, then it would be mutter. But it doesn't matter what your kavana is, according to which it's rather shocking that according to Rabbi Yehuda, since it's irrelevant what you're thinking, so even if you would be mechaven, it would be mutter. Whereas Rava says, no, that's crazy. The most that Rabbi Yehuda said is that you can't be matir something on the basis of not having kavana for it, but he never said that in cases where it's mutter, even if you're mechaving for the iser, that it would be irrelevant. We don't even look at your kavana. That was the two approaches that we had yesterday. And today we want to see whether we can bring rayas for or against either the first approach or the second approach in either Abaye or Rava. So Abaye first wants to bring a raya to his second approach. And he says like this, look, I can prove it to you that basically, according to Rabbi Yehuda, even if you have kavana, it makes no difference. We don't care about that kavana, because look at this. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. This is talking about within the period before the Yomim Tovim. So you would need this enormous place to gather everybody together and to teach them the dinim of the Yontif. So I know you could have like 20,000 people at a shir. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, there were no buildings that could hold those number of people. So what he used to do is he would go to the in front of the Beis HaMikdash, and they would be facing the Heichal, and then the sun would be blocked by the Heichal for much of the day, because the Heichal was 100 amas high, and at least they wouldn't be sitting in the sweltering sun. And it says over there, Shaya Yoshev Bitzilo Shel Heichal, Vidoresh Kol Hayom Kulo. So you would speak like 20,000 people all day long, and there was certainly no other place that they could have managed that. V'ahacha Delo Efshar, but he definitely wanted to be in the shade, and he did it. So you see that I'm right. And that, according to Rabbi Yehuda, it must be that your kavana is irrelevant. So, according to this approach, in other words, because the way we're approaching it now, according to Rabbi Shimon, it would be usur if you did have kavana. So, therefore, I see that we must be going on leaving Rabbi Yehuda. Whereas Rava says, no. That's not the issue. The reason that he sat in the shade of the Heichal is because the shade of the Heichal is not Derech Hana'ah. Remember that we said before, if it isn't Derech Hana'ah, then it's Mutter. Why is it not the Derech Hana'ah? Well, because last I heard, buildings are designed to provide shade for their inside. They're not designed to provide shade for people standing outside. And therefore, what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was doing over here was not being Nene really in a way that would be Usser. So therefore, the Heichal is different, and Latocho Asui. Says Rava, I'll bring you a raya, however, to my approach, that there definitely is an Israel, Libet Rebbe Yehuda, if you do have Kavana. Because take a look in this Mishnah, and you'll see this is the Mishnah in Midos, and it says over there that they used to have these elevators that would open up onto the second story of the Heichal. And then when they needed to have any type of repair inside of the Heichal. So the workmen would enter into one of this. It's like a whole panel of elevators that would go all around the sides. And basically, they would get onto the elevator on the second story, which was an Asur B'Knisa. And then they would be in the elevator when they were lowered into the Heichal in order to perform the work in the Heichal. Now, of course, the modern elevator is made out of glass, so they should be able to get a good look at things, right? But they did not make these elevators out of glass. They made them as closed boxes. And why did they do that? I understand that they needed an elevator, because they certainly wanted to have a separate reshus that the work person was standing in. But, I mean, it would have been enough just to have like a platform, you know, like you do for construction, right? And instead, they actually closed the entire thing like a box that you couldn't see out of. Why did they do that? Because they felt that it was usher for them to look at the beauty of the Kodesh HaKodeshim. So that means they would be nene from the stunning workmanship and so on and so forth. So even though that would be, I mean, certainly, what am I supposed to do? I have to be here in order to fix it. But since they would be mechaven to be nene, apparently it's usher. So, I mean, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying that even if you don't have any choice, like over here, I mean, that's the whole reason they built these elevators, then it must be that since the kavana would be, and we believe that they would end up, even if they didn't want to, they'd end up having that kavana. So must be that even so, the kavana itself answers it. Now, obviously, we can't prove 100% that this is going on Libra Rabbi Yehuda. I mean, remember, Rava is only tining that this is true, Alibet Reb Yehuda, but we don't find that there's any machlokas about this. This was a description of the reality of how things were done. I mean, to make that dependent and say, well, apparently at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, they had Paskin only like Rabbi Shimon, I mean, that doesn't make sense. So this was the reality. So you see that it must be that even Reb Yehuda is made up. And even though he doesn't take seriously Kavana as the central element, he certainly views Kavana as being one element that needs to be taken into consideration. And therefore, if these Po'alim would be working with Kavana to be in it, then they would be over on an Isser. Says Abaye, this you call a proof? Let me ask you something. Let's say, according to you, Vitisbra, let's say that they actually would have been in a glass, and they actually would have desired to see the workmanship and be nene from it, would they really have been over on Me'ila? Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Pasi, Amar Rabbi Shimon Levi Mishum Bar Kapara. Things that do not have any actual physical presence, such as the sound of the musical instruments in the Beis HaMikdash, or the beauty of the workmanship, or the smell of the Ketores. Those things are not going to be Osir Mishum Me'ila. Midiraisa, there would be no Israel. And the Chachomim Osir them. So the only reason that they made such a important change to make sure that they would have these elevators that were completely sealed, obviously the idea over here is out of a very special sense of respect for the Heichal. That's the point, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, you don't want people looking, you know, as if it's open to their eyes. So because of that, it has nothing to do with the Isra, not to try to bring me a raya over here that according to Reb Yehuda, it's usher because he was mechavin. That's not the point. It's an act of protection. Anyway, you can't understand it in any other way because this would not be one of the things, just to look at something, that would not be something that would be considered to be actually taking pleasure from it. Now, others say that actually what Rava said, I'll prove to you that according to Reb Yehuda, Kavana is a problem. Because the Tanya Amar Reb Shimon Pasi Amar Shimon Levi Mishum Bar Kapara, that Kol Umar Avereach Ein Behem Mishum Me'ila. Note what it says over here. He's switching it around. You use this against me. I'm going to use it against you. Because what it says over here is that you will not be over on Me'ila. You won't have to bring a carbon Me'ila and so on, which is a special Chiyav. That's not Stam regular Anah. So that means that there is no Me'ila. But there certainly does seem to be an Isser. So now that Isser would be, I'm assuming, for people that are standing inside of the Beis HaMikdash. They are doing the Aveda. They're playing the musical instruments. They're bringing the Ketoret, right? And my love, lotano omdim bifnim. There's no way they can do it outside the Beis HaMikdash, obviously. This is where the Avoda needs to be done. So it's lo efshar, but the problem is that they're going to be mechaving to be nene, and because of that, it seems clearly that it's usur anyway. So again, I mean, we're not going to assume that this is going dafka libra Rabbi Shimon, right? And Abaya says, I don't know what makes you jump to that conclusion. How do you know we're not talking about people that are standing outside and they can smell the keteris or they can listen to the music and so on? I don't understand what makes you say that it's for the people that are inside who have no choice but to be there. Maybe it's for people outside who do have a choice about being there. That's the point. Okay, Gufa, by the way, just looking into that issue about that you just quoted twice, the issue of sound and looking at something and smell. So you said, Omer Reb Shimon ben Pazi, you said that kol marav reach ein miyam mishum me'ila. Is that true? There's no me'ila? You're telling me, I understand some of them, but the business about reach, smell, is not considered to be me'ilan. It says in the Braita, ha'mefateim et ha'ketoret lehitlamed bas. Somebody actually goes and he makes up the ketoret. So he does the actual compounding of the ketoret, which the Torah says is an iser, an achiev of koras. But when? Only if your intent is lahariach ba. Over here, a guy makes up the ketoret according to its exact proportions and so on, using the correct ingredients. But the reason that he's doing it is because he wants to, let's say, get approval as an authorized ketoret supplier, you know? So he's practicing. Or maybe he already is practiced and he wants to actually make this ketoret in his own home. And he's doing it in order to give it over as a gift to the Beis HaMikdash, but he has no intention of being meiriach ba. So what's the halacha over there? So if he's doing it li'itlamed or lemosra letzibur, so then he's potter. There's no chiyav of koret in that case, because it says, ish asher yaseh kamoa la'riach ba v'nichrat mi'amav. It's obviously not la'riach ba over here. And now here's the deal. If he smelled it, he didn't make it. He just went ahead and he smelled the actual keteres. In other words, while it was burning. So then he would also be potter, but, it says over here he would be over on me'ila. Didn't you just say that smell is not mechayev on me'ila? So how do you explain this? Hello, Amar of Papa, you're right. Actually, Bar Kapora's statement was a bit misleading. The real meaning is like this. Kol umar ein bemishum me'ila. There's no way that sound of an instrument or the way something looks beautiful, there's no way that you could ever be over on me'ila for such a thing because it does not have any physical presence. However, the ktores is considered to be something that is tangible. I mean, you have the actual smoke, you have the molecules that you actually see coming up of the smell and so on. Why would that be called an intangible thing the way music would be or the way just something looking beautiful would be? So you're right. We did make a little mistake how we presented it. So the reason that kolu mare do not have any me'ila is because of what they are. Afisha in behem mamash. They don't have any kind of tangible presence. So there's nothing substantive there. But reach, the din of reach that was included here is not because of that reason, it's for another reason. The reach is referring to la'ach shetale timrato. Talking about over here, you burnt the ketores and the column of smoke goes up. From that column of smoke, now the smell spreads all over the place, right? But once that column of smoke goes up, what's the din? It was nasa mitzvato. You did what you needed to do. The klal is, remember, on anything in the Beit HaMikdash, the moment that it was used for its mitzvah and the mitzvah was completed, at that moment, it no longer is going to be b'chayev yom me'ila. So that's why Bar Kapora threw in the things together. Because generally speaking, when you would be meiriach the ketores, it would be after asiyas mitzvah. So you put the three together. But they're two totally different reasons. Kol amar is because of the mamashut issue, and the other one, which is the smell, referring, of course, to ketoret, because that's the only smell we'd be talking about, that ketoret would be only if it's acher shenaaseit mitzvato. What, you're telling me that whatever we do a mitzvah, there's no longer a din ha-me'ilah? That's not true. Take a look at Trumas HaDeshen. Of course, we've had this question many times before. We already know the answer. But take a look at Trumas HaDeshen. So every single day, the Kohanim go up. They take like this shovelful of completely burned out ash from the Mizbeach. It's completely burned out ash. You would think it's not set mitzvah. Okay, fine. The Torah says it's one additional mitzvah. What's the one additional mitzvah? Take off a truma of it and set it down on the side of the Mizbeach. All very nice. Okay, now can we throw it out? No. The Torah says, v'samo etzel mizbeach. You have to make sure that it stays there and that it is absorbed magically into the ground. Now, why is that? Isn't it completely not set mitzvah? So there's nothing else I need to do with it, right? So you see from there, I would think, that even something that is, you fully completed any action that you could possibly do with it, nonetheless, you have responsibilities still to make sure that it's hidden. And that word v'samo is understood as meaning you put it there and you make sure shelo yifazer. Don't let it scatter. It has to actually be absorbed there. V'samo means you leave it there, buddy. Shelo yaneh. You're not allowed to be nene from it. I thought it was not six mitzvah. So why not say the same thing over here by the Ketoret? So what if it's not six mitzvah? It's no different than the Trumas HaDeshen. And says the Gemara, you would be right, except for the fact that there's another example of a place where the Torah mentions the specific chiyuv of leaving it there, and which means we have shnei ketuvim abayim ke'echad. And wherever you have shnei ketuvim abayim ke'echad, we reason very logically that if one of them was meant as a model, and it's coming to tell me what the din is all over, why would I need to mention another one? So if I have two specific cases, then I view those specific cases as both being unusual and being yotzei min haklal, and therefore shnei ketuvim abayim kechad ein melamdim, because obviously neither of them is meant to serve as a model. That's the point. And what's the other one? Trumas HaDeshen and the Big Day Kuhuna. Here we're referring to the begadim that the Kohen Gadol wears, the Big Day Lavan, that the Kohen Gadol wears on Yom HaKippurim. So we have these shnei ketuvim abayim ke'echad, and they're also not allowed to be used for anything else, even though it was not seis mitzvasa, and therefore they are unique examples, and they're not models. Because kol shnei ketuvim abayim ke'echad, ein melamdim. Trumas HaDeshen, I just told you about that one, that's v'samo, and the big day kuhuna, because it says v'hinichom sham, the Kohen leaves his white begotten there, which means same lashon, sham, basically. So the sham means to unim geniza. They have to be put away there. They're never allowed to be used again. Why not? Apparently because even nasid mitzvah said they're usur bana. So that is another special case. Wait a minute, but not everybody agrees that v'ini chab sham means that they have to be left there and can never be used again. That's, I mean, yeah, the Rabbanan do say that. I mean, so according to Rabbanan, it would work out. So, hey, nichal Rabbanan, it's all very nice according to that, that the, you're telling me to him geniza. But what about according to Rabbi Dosa? Rabbi Dosa, he argues, and he says, that when it says v'nichum sham, all it's saying is that this Kohen Gadol cannot use these begadim again for avodah. Well, obviously can't use it during the year because he has to have eight begadim, and there's only four of these big day lavan. And he can't use it on another Yom Kippur either. That's what it's telling you. He's got to make new begadim next Yom Kippur. But how about if a Kohen Hedyot would want to use these four begadim, which are essentially the equivalents of the Kohen Hedyot? Could he? Yes. So the only meaning, according to Rabbi Doisa, v'nichum sham shelo yishtamish b'em Kohen b'yom ha-kippur ma'acher, but ru'in in the Kohen Hedyot. So ma'ika l'meimah. What are you going to say according to that? Now we only have one example, and it should serve as a model. Namely, Trumas HaDeshen, model. For the concept that even Acher Shenaset Mitzvato, you still should be Chayev. Where do you have the other example that makes it a Yotzei Min HaKlal, a special case? Okay, fine. There's another special case, okay? We still have two special cases, which means that there's no model. The other special case is the Egla Rufa. The Egla Rufa also needs to be left there of a Fusham. Same idea, you need to leave it there. And so we still have Shnei Ketuvim Abayim Ke'echad, V'chor Shnei Ketuvim Abayim Ke'echad, Ein Melamdim, even though I did whatever I needed to be done with it, so you'd say, so who cares what you do with it? Dump it in the garbage, whatever. No, it remains Asurbana. Wait. All true, but only according to Ramandi Omar, who agrees with the principle of Shnei Ketuvim Abayim Ke'echad, Ein Melamdim. So that's very good, according to the Mandi Omer. What about according to the Mandi Omer? Malamdi Michael Amimar. What are you going to say then? And we know the answer because we've seen this many times. Also, in each of these cases, the Torah goes out of its way to put in a mute, to exclude any other examples, and therefore it effectively X's out these cases from being models. Because it says, v'samo etzal mizbeach, only put it, meaning nothing else similar that was not his mitzvato, should be learned out from this. And by the Egla Rufa, it says, ha-egla ha-arufa, this and only this. Okay, fine. Anyway, this was very tangential, right? Okay, so now we thought we've got ourselves some kind of raya. Obviously, so far, we're sort of up in the air over here. So let's see whether we can get another raya to Rava Tashma. We're talking about over here that you've got whatever it's talking about, the Paraduma, or whether it's talking about Egla Rufa, it's not over clear. We're talking about the Pashtus of Egla Rufa. In this case, the second case, we're talking about a Paraduma. But the truth is the two cases are learned from each other with a Hekesh, because in both cases, it says Ol, Shalua Lea Ol. The Gemara darshins that as a Hekesh. So over here, we're talking about the Egla. It's a young calf. Okay. So he goes ahead and he hitches it up to a Rivka. And a Rivka is basically a group, a shed or a team of, in this case, cows, because the mother of the Egla is there. And because she was attached, I mean, he put it there in order for the calf to be next to mommy so that she could get milk whenever she needed milk. Now, because mommy went around dragging the threshing thing that this was attached to, so baby went along also. So if he put it there for her to suckle, even though she walked along with them and she did disha, she stepped over grain and whatever, it's kosher, because he certainly wasn't interested in her working as a baby. But if the reason that he put her there is in order that she should be dash, besides that she should suckle, so then she becomes posel. Okay, now, does she or does she not have to suckle? Yes. Is mother busy and therefore the only way she's going to be around mother is to be able to hitch her up? Yes. Nonetheless, what does it say over here? The very fact that you wanted her also to thresh, that assers her. So you see from here that just because of the kavana, it becomes asser. And that's exactly what I am saying, says Robert. It proves this idea again. I mean, if we really wanted to, we could have claimed this is going to Rabbi Shimon, the way Rava understood it, but we didn't feel that that's a correct approach. Start making about clokers where we don't see anything. So this proves my idea, says Rava, that according to Rabbi Yehuda, the Kavana most certainly is significant. No, says Igmara. This is a special case as well. This is the Perek of special cases. So why is this a special case? I mean, all the special cases we had about the Isuri Achila that aren't Isuri Ano. Now we have all the special cases where there's no problem of Kavana and so on. In this case, it's a special case in which your Kavana takes on a completely different meaning, because the Torah uses the passive tense. So it says, Asher lo ubadba. It means it has to be an Egla Arufa that no work was done with. What do you mean, was done with? I mean, what would that mean? Like the mother dragged the baby along and ended up that the baby was dash. Would that be included? Well, we'll see. But certainly it means that you can't do work with it even if you didn't make her do it. And that was the case over here. The halakha is just where even if I didn't make her do it, so my kavon is not the issue. It's the ubadba, it's the passive that's the issue. Look, baby, it was done. Doesn't matter whether I wanted it done or didn't want it done. I don't understand. You just said that it does matter whether you want it done or didn't want it done. So why in the first case? If you're darshing asher lo ubadba, so then that would mean, even in that first case, where all you wanted to do is for the baby to get a good suckle, and mommy starts walking and drags baby along, which should also be possible. You said it's not. The only element that's different between the two cases was your kavana. So what are you telling me, lo ubadba? What does lo ubadba deal with kavana? I don't understand. So why is the first case any different? I'm missing something. The point over here is, take a look. We have the same idea that is mentioned in Gabi Paraduma, where over there it says like this. Now, remember, we do learn out Paraduma from Egla Rufa. We learn them out from each other. The passive sense of Ubadba by the Egla Rufa, we apply as well to the case of Paraduma. So let's take a look at these two cases over here. Here we have a Paraduma who is sitting around munching placidly in her pasture, and this big crow comes down and sits down on her back. So she's doing work. She's holding up the bird. Maybe she even carries him around. Does she become posel because the Lashon is shelo ubadba? No, she does not become posel. We'll see why not indeed. How about if a nice big bull comes up and sees this beautiful redhead? How about if he mounts her? Is he going to posel her? So now she's carrying around a bull. So this already would posel her. Why is that? Where do we get such an idea from? My taima, Amar Rav Papa, look, it's the same idea that we have, remember, about ki yitain and ki yutan. We read it one way, and we actually pronounce it the other way. So we reach a compromise in those cases, right? So ki yitain dumya to ki yutan. Remember how many times we've had that? So it would mean there's a kiyutan, even though it's passive, but it has to be dumya the kiyutain, meaning that I have to want it. So that is how kavana enters the picture, you see. So the same thing is true over here. If the Torah would have written the word asher lo avadba, now it's written avad, it's not written with avav, it's written avad. So if that would have been the correct way to read it, the karina avad, it would have meant only where the guy himself puts her to work on that job. If it would have been written ubad with the vav, and we would have also read it ubad, so then it would have meant completely passive, even if he had nothing to do with it. But now we have to reach this compromise between ubad and avad. So now that the writing looks like it reads avad, and the way in which the Kriya is given to us is that we're supposed to pronounce it ubad, and we have the same idea, ubad dumya de avad. So the avad obviously means I went out to do it, so there it's nechali, it has my dot. Av ubad de nechali, so anything that I am appreciative of, that would be sufficient, even though I don't actively set it up. So I have absolutely no interest in this crow on her back, but I certainly do have interest in her reproducing, and therefore it is considered to be my das. And that would explain the two cases over here. In the first case, all I wanted her to do is suckle, I do not want her to be working. She's a little baby still, it's an Egla Rufa, and I'm not happy with it. In the second case, where I set it up that she should actually do the disha, so over there, the das is in fact what would have been Mechayev me. But this is only because of the special case again of the Ubad and the Avad. Let's see if we can bring another. Okay, here's another proof. Somebody finds an Aveda. So this Aveda is a beautiful tablecloth or a beautiful hanging, a wall hanging, right? So now, what's the din? Well, you're not allowed to use that for yourself. So let's imagine a case where you've got these very important guests coming, bosses coming for dinner. You've got a pretty simple looking house and you found this $10,000 beautiful wall hanging. You figure what better time to put this wall hanging on the wall? You're not allowed to use the other guy's wall hanging to pretty up your house, right? But suppose anyway you need to spread out this wall hanging, because one of the dinim of an Aveda is that you have to make sure that it's properly aired out and doesn't get infested with moths or whatever, right? So that one of the things is, if it's a book, you have to, it's a safer, you have to roll it and things like that. So over here, you're going to have to hang it up. So now what it says is, if you found an Aveda, this is a bedspread, don't spread it over your bed. Don't put it over a wall, what do you call those? Not a peg. What do you call it? You know, like a thing where you have a hanger. My aphasia. Anyway, whatever, you know, a thing sticking out of a wall to hang things on. Okay. It's only, you know, Lush and Kitsura, a thing sticking out of the wall that you hang things on. There's got to be a better solution. Okay. So don't put it on there, not for your purposes, right? But if it needs it, you could spread it over your bed, or you could spread it over the thing that sticks out of the wall for hanging purposes, because it needs it in order to get the air in it. Ah, now, suppose it just happens to be the day that the boss is coming to visit. So, no, that's the wrong time. Do not use it to cover your couch. Do not use it to put up on the wall, even if you need to use it for its own purposes. Now, aha, so what do you see? Even though I have to use this beautiful wall spread, right? But the very fact that I am being mechaven, that the boss should think that I've got nice things, that already I want to be nene from it, and it's usher. She says, Rava, you see, the thought is absolutely definitive. Says Gemara, that's not the point over there. The point over there is that you're burning the thing up. You have a right to protect it, not to burn it up. Burning it up? Yeah. I mean, what if the boss is a ganav? I know some people standing right here whose boss is a ganav. Do I get a smile? I do. So what if the boss is a ganav? And now the boss sees this beautiful hanging and he thinks, aha, what better place to break into tonight than to steal this beautiful hanging? And anyway, even if he isn't a ganav, you know, I mean, he's got an iron aura. You know what? My employee's got a nicer wall hanging than I have. So that he's not going to put up with. So the INR itself will be burning it up. All right, so this is not much of a riot. Now, we've given up on proving Rava's second shot. Now let's see if we can bring a riot to Rava's first shot. And Rava's first shot was that there's a difference in Rabbi Shimon between where it's reasonable to expect you to pick up the chair instead of dragging it or not. Now, do you have an easy option? Toshma. So here we could take a look at the Mishnah in Kilayim, and there it's talking about also a case we've had many times before where people go around selling suits that are shotness. So they've got like 10 suits that they walk around on the street, you know, hey, buddy, would you like to buy a suit? How about this one? Hey, what about this one? And so on. Give you a good deal. Okay, so then they're carrying around these suits, one on top of the other, right? So they are allowed to do that as long as they are not thinking, whew, it's a good thing I got all of these suits because, man, it's cold outside. So they can't be thinking that because then they're going to be nenev from the kilayim. Instead, they got to be saying, oh, man, I can't take this. Whew, it is so hot. So then there's no problem of wearing the kilayim because then it's not the derech levisha, right? But the tsnuim, people that are want to be very, very makpid on the mitzvah, so they take this stick, they put all of the different suits up on a stick, and they hold the stick behind them, and then they're walking around with these different suits along the stick. Now, that means that it's not necessary to do that, but it's possible to do that, in which case there's an option. The option is to go and do it like the tsnuim, and if there's no kavana, it still is mutter. Uh-oh. Rava said that in that case, if there's an option, it is not mutter. So how all of a sudden does now Rava going to explain this? Can you tell me? He can't. It's actually a teyufta. Teyufta, laman damatni lishna kama, the Rava. The way Rava was originally learning, and that is that alibet Rabbi Shimon, if there's an option, then you cannot rely on a dover shenim iskaven, is hereby officially discontinued. Now, the only approach that we have now in Rava would be the second approach, and we haven't been able to prove it. Tiyufta. Okay, let's go back now to the Mishnah. Now, look, our perek is about to get more interesting, much more interesting, maybe devastatingly interesting. It's an awful lot of serious issues that the Perek is going to bring up. So we started off sort of easy, okay? We're going to look into the interrelationship of Yisrael Hanon, Yisrael Chila, Derech Hanon, Derech Achila, Mechavein, Inu Mechavein. Yes, okay, that's sort of straightforward. We went through all of the cases, and we think we have a pretty good grasp of things now. But there's a lot of issues to come. By the way, one of the most fascinating issues is that the din of Hagolas Kalim, which is some of the really most complex dinim in terms of kashras, we're also going to be getting to, but not today. So today, what we're going to start looking into is the question of what happens of the impact of Isurei Hana'ah on something once you have used it. So the case in the Mishnah brought up not using your chametz to heat up the oven. And we said that would be a chiddush according to Reb Yehuda, because since according to Reb Yehuda, ein bir chometz ala sreifa, you might have thought that since I'm being nene at the time that I'm being mekayim the mitzvah, so then there would be no iser kamash malan that there is. But this brings up the general question of what happens if you use isrei hana to make yourself an oven. Because if this is the first time that you heat the oven, then there's really no way to undo the benefit that you got out of it, right? Because you heated it up, you fired the oven. Like we saw in Kalim, once you heat up that Cheres oven to the point that you've already made Sufganiyot, which I'm assuming you did on Chanukah, not on Erev Pesach, but at that point, it's already considered to be a Kli. So you can't undo it. So does that mean it's kaput? Because it was made with Isurei Hana'ah? So it's now permanently an object of Isurei Hana'ah? Like, how exactly does Isurei Hana'ah translate into use and into an extant position of Isur? Now, that is quite complex. One of the things that it's nogea is the question that is technically called Yesh Shevach Etzim Bepat, which means, do we consider that it's the actual wood that was burned. I mean, obviously, this is a model for the idea, but it was the actual wood that was burned that is now embedded in this bread, because that energy is a direct transcription of the wood being as E equals MC squared, and there must be some type of trade-off between the energy and the wood, even though it may not be detectable, and therefore, this is the wood that you're looking at. In which case, you could never eat this bread, or you could never utilize this particular stove, because this stove is now being held together by the energy that was provided by the wood that was actually Isurei Hana'ah, and that is always there, because energy was just another form of that wood. So now, what would be the din? As it turns out, that itself is more complex than it actually sounds, because we also need to consider that at the time that we actually got the heat into the oven or into the bread, we needed to have already performed combustion, right? The combustion produced the heat, but the heat came because of the oxidation. And once the oxidation was done, it sure ain't wood anymore. So now it's basically what we have is carbon at this point. You might as well wait until something is carbonized and then burn it as charcoal and say that that stuff is considered to be the wood. Well, it's not the wood anymore. So this is a complicating factor, in which case there are two ways of understanding all of these questions, and that is the actual fire at the moment that the original combustion takes place, is that exposed to the bread, or are we using the heat? If we're using the heat, then it's not problematic. But according to Rebbe, if you're in the presence of the actual energy that is emitted at the moment of combustion, then you are utilizing the wood that has been transformed through the oxidation, and therefore it remains us. So Rebbe says, if you once warmed it up, we're going to take the case of chametz, let's take the case of klipe orla. So you have fruit peels, which are considered to be osur banah for orla. You dry them out, and you now fire it up for the first time, your new oven, or kashin, shokloya kerb, everything becomes osur, including the straw. So the idea over there, if it's a new oven, forget it. There's nothing to do with it. All you can do is break it and throw it out. Because from this point forward, oh, we got Yedidya back? Good. Don't let him go again. So from this point forward, it is basically going to be Osir Ba'ana'a itself. That's the point. And therefore, you're going to have to bust it. If it's an old oven, so then you could allow it to cool down. Now you've lost all of that energy. And now when you're going to reheat it, so fine. You're not being Nene from Isirei Ana'a the next time. Don't bring Isirei Ana'a, obviously. Now, how about if you baked some bread in it while it was all heated up with this Isirei Ana'a? So Rebbe says, look, it's the same thing. The bread is forever usher because there's no way to undo that. You made the bread with this energy. Because again, remember that we're talking about where it was made in the presence of the direct energy of the combustion and not from the subsequent heat, which is coming now from that which is no longer wood, but is charcoal. So therefore, Rebbe says, there's nothing to do. You can never eat that bread. Whereas the Chachamim say, no, that bread is perfectly okay because, look, you shouldn't have used it for that purpose, but we don't see the permanent presence, not in the oven and not in the bread. Don't let him go. Ah, I can't believe it. Akiva, what's with you? You finally had an option here. He used to be much more attentive to the daf. I don't know. I think Shmueli's going to have a talk. Okay. So what's the idea over here? That it was usher to use, but once you did it, you don't say that the presence, there we go, good. We like having you. That the presence of that heat is now in the bread, and that energy has made the bread usher. And if you cook the bread over coal, then for sure there's no problem. So in that case, divrei hakol mutar, because at that point, even Rebbe holds it's mutar, because the coals, remember, are carbonized. And there it's not in the presence of the direct energy of the original combustion. Okay, so we've got now, so far, these three different stages. Now, the problem is that we've got a contradiction. The contradiction is that there's another braita that says it doesn't matter whether the oven is old or new. You do not have to destroy the oven. You could just let the oven get cold. So I'd explain the fact that in the first braita, it said you have to bust the oven. And in the second braita, it says you can cool the oven. Then what's the problem? I mean, we know there's a difference. We know that Rebbe said that the new oven is usher, right? Because, I mean, he said the bread is always usher, so he must be the one who said that the oven is always usher, because that oven will always embed the energy of that original combustion. So, whereas this one is going to the Rabbanan, and the Rabbanan said the bread is okay. Why? Because obviously they don't buy into that, that we take a look at the energy as being embedded in something, it permanently is the equivalent of being nana directly from that wood. Okay, so what's your problem? No, you are making an assumption which is simplistic. And I'll tell you why it's simplistic. All that we saw from Rebbe in that first braita is that he was ready to say the concept of yesh shevach etzim bepat. That's all that we saw. In other words, we saw that the bread itself would be a permanent presence of the Isir Ha'ana'a, and therefore you can't eat it, okay? That does not mean that I have to bust up the oven. Why not? Well, it's very simple. If I'm going to be using this oven, I'm only going to be using this oven in conjunction with new energy sources, right? Okay. If that's the case, it's always going to be zeh v'zeh gorem. When I'm eating the bread, at that point, I am eating the energy, so to speak, directly. It's embedded in the bread. If I now go and reheat the oven, and now I bake another bread, there's not going to be any problem in that other bread because that other bread requires the input of additional energy besides the use of the oven in order to hold the energy in it, which is a secondary utilization of the energy, obviously. So now you're going to tell me, well, if you have two different inputs that are necessary in order to get an output, that nonetheless, even if one of those inputs is Osir, the output is Osir. Rebbe never said that. He never said that. He was talking about a case where there was one input and one output. Input energy, output a tanur that holds together. You're talking about two inputs, tanur and fuel, new fuel, kosher fuel. And you're saying if either one of those inputs are osir, then the output, which would be the bread, is osir. And because of that, you're going to have to destroy the oven because it's unusable. Nonsense. It's not true. All that I saw was yet shevach etzim bepat. However, now what is the technical term for two inputs equals one output? Ze v'ze goreim. Did we ever see that in a case of ze v'ze goreim, that Rebbe would also say that it's osir? Where you have two necessary elements in order to be able to achieve an end, that makes something usser? Show me who it is. Don't tell me it's Rebbe just because at the end of the first brisa, Rebbe said that the bread isn't kosher. Show me who claims that you've got to destroy that tanur, because I definitely do not see it as following what Rebbe says at all. I just don't get it. So, now, I'm sure that you're going to be bothered by some. You just need to. This is one of the most complex things. We're definitely doing a very simplistic approach on it, but everything I said is true as far as it goes. Now, I mean, there's an obvious problem, which I'm sure you're not going to let me get away with, which is it's all very nice to say that if I used the tanur together with new fuel, that the bread wouldn't be osir because one plus one does not equal isir, right? But that doesn't mean that I'm allowed to use the tanur, does it? I mean, didn't Rebbe say the tanur is osir bana? So he's telling you break it because we don't want you to use it. The fact that he didn't say, and if you use it, it's going to be osir to eat the bread, that doesn't follow. So we never claim that Rebbe held zev zegorim is osir. We just claim that this tanur embeds yisrei ana, and therefore you're a bad boy if you use it. Not that if you did use it, it would need to be osir. So what makes you say the idea that I should be able to use it in the first place? So I would like you to keep that in mind. We won't deal with the question now because it comes up more clearly tomorrow and we'll be able to address it more fully in the context of the sugya, but we are definitely not sweeping it under the table here. This is a very serious issue. Okay, but meanwhile, we're stuck with this question. Who, in fact, is the source of the idea that Zev Zegorim would be us? Okay, I got it. Lokasha. The one that says that you have to break the oven is Reb Eliezer, who does hold Zev Zegorim is us. And the second brisa, that was going according to Rabbanan, and they said Zev certainly, they said even the bread is kosher. So for sure, there's no problem. Wait, excuse me, which Reb Eliezer? Only Reb Eliezer I know says something very different. I mean, I know what you're thinking, and boy, are you wrong. I mean, are you thinking about Reb Eliezer in the sugya of Seor? The case over there was that we had this Mishnah in Masechet Orla, and the Mishnah over there talks about a case that we've spoken about many times. You've got the sourdough, and a little bit of it is from Truma, and a little bit of it is from Chulin. Now, sounds like a classic Zev Zegorim setup. You don't have enough truma to make the chimutz happen. So I couldn't have actually been able to leaven it utilizing just one or the other. I need both of them. So what would be the din in terms of whatever bread I made with these two inputs? Can only a kohen eat it since half of the input was truma, even though it wouldn't have been enough on its own? Or do we say, since it was Zev Zegorim, it would be mutter? Okay, that sounds like the classic setup of Zev Zegorim. Now, if you're telling me that based on that Mishnah, we know Reb Eliezer, look, the BBs are back into video games during Daf Yomi again. Now, look, this has got to stop. Somebody's having way too much fun over there. So let's get back to the Daf, boys. Okay. So the question over here would be, that im ein bezeh kedei lachmit, ein bezeh kedei lachmit, when it start fuvachim too, and then they got together, and between the two of them, you had enough to make the dough into chametz. So Reb Eliezer says, go according to whatever falls in last. And if the Kulin fell in last, then it's Kulin. If the Truma fell in last, then it's Truma. Whereas the Chachamim say, doesn't matter whether it fell in first, what falls in last, since it can only become Chometz with acting together, it is Olameinu Aser Ad She'ebo Kedei Lachmitz, because you have to have in the Iser itself sufficient, and you do not, because this is actually a Zevezeh Garim case. That's the point. But Abaye said over there, as far as Rebbe Eliezer is concerned, and this is the only way that things sort of get clear. Because what would be the difference whether it's first or last? So Abaye says the real meaning of Rebbe Eliezer is like this. Let's imagine that the truma falls in first. Okay, what happens to the dough? Discernibly, nothing. Correct? Because there's not enough in there, and there's a certain tipping point in terms of the leavening process. I don't reach the tipping point. But when you don't reach a tipping point, does that mean that nothing was achieved chemically? Obviously not. Okay, something was achieved, it's non-detectable. We now take out the iser. That's what we're talking about, says Abaye. We take out the iser, and now the chulin falls in. That's what Rabbi Yeshua was saying. He was saying that in the event that you have a non-detectable process, and remember that halacha does not recognize non-detectable processes, as we've seen many times. So therefore, as far as I'm concerned, said Rabbi Eliezer, we measure the impact of the last event. The chulin falls in. Wow. Look, all of a sudden the whole thing turns into chametz. And that would mean that we have the, this has something to do with Pesach, by the way. It's just that chimotz is the same as emulsifiers, right? Anything in which you have something that provides its presence is not going to be bottled in a mixture. So one of those things is leavening agents. If you take a look at your candy bar, you know, you can ask your DJ now just to show you what he's eating. And you'll find it doesn't have any food in it, but it does have leavening agents. Ah, and it does have emulsifiers. Ah. And it does have colorants. Ah, there you go. And it must have tasting things, you know, maybe E-135 and other poisons. So altogether, the question would be, the leavening agents would be sufficient to answer it. All I see in terms of the actual impact is the final leavening agent, which in this case was chulin, not truma. So I don't have to worry about it. That's what Rebbe Eliezer was saying, says Abaye. But if you did not take out the iser, and then, in fact, you had the impact of both the truma and the chulin, then Rebbe Eliezer would have said that it was osir. Why? Because he holds zevezeh goreim is osir. So I'm assuming that this is what you meant when you said Rebbe Eliezer. You're making an awful big assumption, which is that Abaye is the only correct way of reading Rebbe Eliezer. Okay, we'll have to see Rebbe Eliezer. We'll have to see whether that's true tomorrow.